Hey, everybody, this is Shop Talk Show. This episode is brought to you in part by lynda.com, the online learning platform with over 3,000 on-demand video courses to help strengthen your business, technology, and creative skills. For a free 10-day free trial for Shop Talk listeners specifically, go to lynda.com/shoptalk. Is also brought to you by the CSS Dev Conference, in which both me and Dave will be at, along with all the kinds of other awesome people that have been on this show, like Jonathan Snook, Val Head, Sarah Sway Dan. We have had Sarah on, haven't we? I believe we have. Because she was one of those guests that I really wanted to get on for a long time. Oh, yeah, I remember. There's other guests in that category, though. Anyway, CSS DevConf is going to be really fun. It's out in Long Beach, California, which is, I guess, the LA kind of area. I haven't spent a lot of time there, but I'm looking forward to it, especially because it's on a giant weird boat that's like permanently docked there, and it looks amazing, and I can't wait to spend time on it. CSS DevConf, known for being at cool, weird locations and stuff. Anyway, that's literally cssdevconf.com. We'll tell you about more of those things, but for now, let's kick off this unusual show, Dave.
Hey there, Shopping Maniacs. You're listening to another special episode of the Shop Talk Show. Chris, why is it so special?
Well, you know, I guess it's hard for me to keep, because we record things out of order a little bit sometimes. But not so long ago, we did a panel, right? Yep. In the panel, we credited JS Jabber because it's kind of their, not that like they invented the concept of a panel, but it's the format of their show is they have some permanent kind of panelists, kind of like me and Dave, and then they invite on not always one, but sometimes many multiple people to talk about a very specific concept. So we moved away a little bit from Q&A, which is kind of the foundation of Shop Talk Show, and probably always will be.
This is like our Burning Man season, where we're just going out, exploring, and finding ourselves.
That's good. Maybe yeah. We'll... you know, whatever. Drop a little peyote and see what happens. we'll see. I heard it's very safe. We explored their format a little bit, and we have some other ones planned that we're going to explore. We're going to do maybe we'll do a little Terry Gross style interview stuff. We'll see what happens. In this one, we're going to borrow a format from our friends Liz Andran and Nikki Brown, who do a show called Page Break Podcast.
It's one of my favorite shows. And if you're not familiar, Nikki and Liz will sit down and they will discuss either a blog post, and it's like a little 7-minute podcast, or they'll read a book together, which is like a full hour long podcast. It's really one of my favorite
book club, and they record it. How awesome is that?
Yeah, it's like my favorite. Like, when I think about podcasts that have formulas, I'm like, I always go to this one because I think it's so successful. Because they just, it's like, this is what we do. And we just, you know, make it happen. And it's great. So every time, it's really thoughtful. Well.
I mean, go to the website and just read the first paragraph. I mean, that's good web design, too, when you're just, there's just no mystery about what things are. You know, it's just like Page Break is an audio podcast hosted by Liz Andra and Nikki Brown. Join us Tuesday for discussion on books in a 20 to 50 minute form. You know, it's just like, we're going to tell you how it is. It's just so great. Anyway, we're going to copy it.
Yeah. So don't put it out in public because we'll steal it. It's sort of the message.
So like Dave's like, let's read something together and we'll talk about it. And Dave picked out a very interesting thing for us to read. It wasn't a book because that's a lot of words.
Well, it's officially a book, I guess.
It is a book. And I ordered the book because I enjoyed reading the article, I guess. Or what do you call what's a fancy word for an article?
A collection of essays.
Okay, yeah. It's called The Cathedral and the Bazaar. I'm sure many of you have heard of it. Apparently Dave had heard of it. I had literally never heard of it. Never came up for me in my circles. Maybe it's less I don't know, Dave's a little bit more back-endy than
yeah,
I am.
So it's about open source, and I pulled it from a talk by Jacob Thornton Fat on Twitter, where he did a talk about why does open source suck and I hate it or something. It was really, I'll try to find a link.
For really? So he doesn't necessarily agree with this.
Well, he just was kind of doing the history, and he mentioned Cathedral and the Bazaar, and I was like, I'm sad about open source, so I would like to learn more about it, the history of it. And it just so happens that this is an amazing, like, I don't know, like almost like prophetic, you know, it just describes open source like to a T. Would you, I don't know, maybe I'm getting too
well, we're dedicating our entire show to this, so I'm sure we'll get to all those concepts, but it's old. That's something that you should know about it before we start talking about it. Not you know whatever 1800s old. It's old for software. 1997 was the first draft of it, I think, and then it has been updated a number of times and possibly expanded until the version that me and Dave read is from the year 2000, and I don't believe has been touched since then. There is a book. I ordered it just because it seems like I enjoyed this, so maybe I'll read the book. I'm not sure if how different the book and this essay are. Even just finding the essay to read is slightly challenging. I mean, it's hosted on a website, but the website looks like it's from about that time.
Yeah.
And, you know, Rose. there's the content has a bit rot a little bit. In fact, I downloaded a PDF because I wanted to, like, take notes in it and stuff, and I thought it might be nice to, you know, a format that I could jump across, you know, to my mobile and stuff as I was reading it. And, you know, like, any text that's italicized for some reason doubled up in my PDF. So what happened there?
Well, yeah, anyway. It's probably like not even UTF-8. It's like it's probably like encoded in Latin. ISO 8859-1.
Could be. Yeah, definitely.
There's your
problem. So it's just to set the stage here a little bit. We were trying to read a piece of content that wasn't exactly a typographic masterpiece, you know, which kind of fits the vibe in a sense of this thing. It is written by a man named Eric Stephen Raymond, and apparently he's often referred to as ESR because he's made quite a name for himself through this essay and book and his work. So he's a kind of a Linux dude. I mean, so I don't know. Do you want to, I don't know much about him, so I'm not going to give him the story of Eric's life or anything here. All I've done is read this essay of his, but the whole deal is, and you know, so it's an unusual title, isn't it? The Cathedral and the Bazaar. It's kind of an amazing title for something. It seems like a kind of book I would read, but he explains what's a cathedral and what's a bazaar, right? He just goes right into it. And do you want me to hand that off to you, Dave, or
sure.
Should I explain that?
So the cathedral and the bazaar are two different styles of development. You know, there's the cathedral, which is the, yeah, we planned everything, we architected it really well, and when it ships, it's perfect and immaculate.
Big brick walls, nobody's allowed in, nobody can see in, and he likens that to, and this shows its age a little bit, but the Emacs software, which has been around a long time, still is around, but apparently there's a team that works on that editor, and there it's not open source, it's just like there's a core team of people that work on it, and they put out releases sometimes, and it just is what it is. I guess if we're likening it to modern times, it might be something like, well, anything that's closed source, like Apple software or something, or even GitHub isn't open source, you know, like what we get from Team GitHub, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yep. I think it brought up like Microsoft in the late 90s, 2000s, you know, or early 2000s, or Apple now, which is hard to admit, but they are very walled garden.
Sure. It's just anything but open source. It's like there's a team of developers that work on this thing. This is the cathedral we're talking about. And it's just for everybody that uses that software, you just kind of get what you get versus the bazaar, Dave,
And the bazaar is sort of the Linux model, which is just pandemonium. if you think about it, like people selling garbage in the street or whatever, or trinkets or things, it's just a million people. You don't control a single one. Let's make commerce happen is sort of that's the approach. And he really gloms on to Linus Torvald and the whole Linux explosion. Which
I could read
happening.
A passage potentially. Maybe that would be useful.
Let's read it.
Linus Torvald's style of development, release early and often, which is how often have you heard that? That probably came from this essay. Release early and often, delegate everything you can, be open to the point of promiscuity, came as a surprise. No quiet, reverent cathedral building here. Rather, the Linux community seemed to resemble a great babbling bazaar of different agendas and approaches, aptly symbolized by the Linux archive sites who'd take submissions from anyone, or in my PDF, anyone, because it was italicized. At first, I thought it was like a cool touch to this. But
like he's really poetic.
Who'd take submissions from anyone out of which a coherent and stable system could seemingly emerge only by a succession of miracles.
which is
how he starts out, but yeah.
I think that accurately describes a lot of open source software, if I'm completely honest.
Sure. So he's comparing that, and Linux is like the ultimate example because it has thousands of contributors and everybody's got their own agenda and what they want to work on and stuff. This is, so there's a bunch of rules, as we'll go through in this essay, that are all kind of interesting and largely stand the test of time. And lots of quotes from this are still in the modern vernacular. Like part of the Linux thing was that, what's that one? And we've said it on this show a number of times, I think, that given enough eyeballs, all bugs are shallow. Have you heard that one?
That's Linus's from this essay. Law. That's from here.
It's Linus's law that ESR
kind
made.
Of dubbed.
Dubbed, or what do you call that? Coined?
Coined, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so it's just a really nice sounding metaphor for two different styles of development. And then goes on to tell a story, and Eric's story is largely him looking at Linux and a few other projects and a project that he's running in his he works on mail fetchers, and they all have different names, but it was kind of, this is a long time ago. I mean, first of all, let's set the year tone a little bit. Again, this was originally written in 1997. And revised through the 2000s. What was happening during that time?
Well, I can tell you because I went to college in 1998, and I had to. They sit you down and they say, "Okay, Telnet into this IP address," which Telnet is basically pre-websites. It's like, you go into this computer, this IP address, and you sign up for an email. And then you type these explicit commands like, whatever, fetch mail or and then you'll get this really weird GUI that you can kind of keyboard through to open your email. All on these green screens, that was sort of the flavor of the day. And I think he's basically writing a piece of software to run on these types of machines, these sort of very small, they connect over a 56K modem, which was actually kind of fast, but yeah, this is like pre-Ethernet, and broadband. This is connecting to, your email on some server, or you could maybe, I guess, be hosting.
And there was web,
it.
But it was very early, and there was kind of coexisting with things like Telnet at the time. I think. Mm-hmm. I think part of his mail fetching was that I think at some point he like despised having to Telnet in for his mail, and he was preferring the non-Telnet version of essentially email.
Yeah, I think he wanted kind of a local client to just fetch the mail, and he ended up calling it fetch mail, right?
Eventually, it became fetch mail. Yeah, and that's great. And it was, things that we recognize today, POP3 and even IMAP. Then I thought IMAP was much newer than that, but apparently it was working on that feature even back then.
I thought Apple invented it with the phone because they were like, people are going to want to check their phones and their computers in sync. But
it's funny. I mean, CSS2, I think, is about this time, which is I don't really think of people talking about CSS1 all that much, but that was like end of 96. And then I think it was so weird that it's really CSS2 is the thing that we kind of think of as kind of normal CSS. was like 1997, 1998. So that was happening just then. I mean, it's clearly not super popular, but was just starting to be birthed at that time. There's a couple of other things that happened around that time that are of relevance to Shop Talk Show people, I think. One is that classic article that we refer to all the time is the Tao of Web Design article, right?
Yeah.
That was released in 2000, so it was right about at the same time that this article is being written. Apparently, a lot of philosophers during this time.
Early web philosophers.
Which is John Alsop, right? And there's an article I published not so long ago on CSS Tricks called Design for Community by Derek Powazak that also has this prophetic feeling of writing. And I reviewed it in the context, largely what we're doing now and this show. And that was released in 2001, talking about kind of online communities and stuff. So that, you know, this is an article that fits in that you know, trio.
I think what's really shocking is to read an article from 1997. Like, it's a book, but it's really just like 9 blog posts or something like that. But it's really weird to read this. And almost spooky that it applies so much now. And the Tao of web design is another great example of that. It's like, whoa, this is the same. Like, nothing has changed. Oh my God, no progress. So I found myself approaching it from kind of 3 different ways. You know, I approached it from obviously like I do open source and. You know, how do I make websites or how do I manage open source projects? That was the first one. I thought about it from a product perspective. Like, how do you, like, we're doing Daytrip, you're doing CodePen. How do you, like, build a product? I feel like there's tips and stuff.
Well, it's impossible for us to have read this without bringing along our personal experiences here. So that certainly we're going to try to attach some of these principles to those projects and just see how that goes.
Yeah. And the third one was also as like a user and of companies I like and stuff like that. Like, how do I kind of perceive things in that way? So, yeah.
Yeah, and was this prophetic is the question. I think it was in some ways and not in some others. So, you know, the easiest way to go through this is probably by the rules, because I think that's what drives this kind of the momentum of this article. He's telling stories, but then kind of stops to say, here's one of the rules. And one of them, because he was working on these, you know, these mail client fetcher things, was that he came to realize that the reason he was working on it and spending time on it is because he really wanted it. I mean, I guess that's obvious, but he had this desire to have a mail fetcher program for himself that did the job and did the things he wanted it to do. In fact, he talks about, you know, hacking on a feature that he really wanted and stuff. So the very first rule became... Every good work of software starts by scratching a personal developer's itch. Now, think of the way he put it there. People still say that verbatim.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you knew he was the first person to ever say that, but like if you grabbed 100 startup people, like founders, and said, literally 100 of them, and lined them up, and they couldn't hear each other, and you said, give me your 1 minute elevator pitch, I bet 75% of them would say, well, I was just trying to scratch my own itch, you know? Like, it's become trite. It's become like, gosh, I hope you are. In fact, maybe it's just a pet peeve of mine, but like, you know, you better be, you know? But it's become, you know, maybe it came from this, maybe it didn't, maybe it just has entered the culture of the world, but people still say this all the time.
Yeah. This is like number one software philosophy. Like, I know Rails did this to the max. This was probably like, I wasn't intending this to like, just knock me off my feet, but this was like something I've been thinking about. Have you used apps where you're like using it and you're like, no one from that company actually uses this application. A new one for me is maybe Windows, Twitter for Windows. It's like clearly the people working on this don't use Windows. Another one is maybe like Twitter, the phone client, you know, because it's like, I'm picking on Twitter, but it's like they're running some A/B tests now, and it's just like, have you guys ever like used your app because your decisions are horrible? Or like when you're scrolling Twitter and you hit the like little follow guy button on the like right rail because you had that was the only place you could scroll. Anyway.
So that's it's you're trying to solve a problem that you have, and then Dave, you've kind of extended it, which I think is apt to it needs to keep scratching your itch.
Right. Like use your software. If you're not using it, like it just I don't know, it just doesn't make sense. You're not aware of your problems, I guess would be what I'm kind of saying from a software thing. You know, I think, you know, in some open source stuff I'm getting dangerously close to that. You know, I don't use Fitvids that much, you know. We'll probably mention Fitvids 100 times in the show, but I don't use Fitvids and that often, and it just is sort of just sitting there because I don't use it, you know. So
Well, we definitely will get to that because it's going to talk about our own projects. It really quickly moves on to the second rule. Eric was working on some pop stuff, and it turned out that a different project was a little more robust and stuff. And he kind of was like, "Man, what was faced a kind of fork in the road? Do I stick with this one or do I move to this other one and kind of put my development effort behind that? And there's already some existing code here that I could use." And the rule becomes great programmers know what to write, or good programmers know what to write, great ones know what to rewrite and reuse.
Boom.
Yeah, that's a kind of a big deal. Still something we talk about on Shop Talk regularly, and it often comes up just because of the kind of the topics that we talk about on Shop Talk, just because of what gets sent in and stuff, are things like, and I'm just going to drop WordPress here, large open source project, but it's kind of like, it comes up in the should I code my own CMS or use WordPress? Or should I use this plugin or should I do it my custom way? Or should I use this tool or not, or this other tool? Or
should I use Bootstrap or Foundation? Like, well, great programmers know what to write.
Great programmers use Bootstrap. He's saying great programmers know when to use Bootstrap and know when writing their own thing would be useful.
Which I think that's huge. That's almost revolutionary to the discussions we have on Shop Talk.
We should just refer to this and be like, should I use Bootstrap? Well, if you're a great programmer, you'll just know.
Yep, Shop Talk. You heard her here, has been replaced by a book from 1997 entirely. Mm-hmm. Oh, God. This one was good, too, because it was just, you know, he's faced with, he's like, should I write my own mail client from scratch? I have a little bit of code to do that. Or should I take this one? And he kind of chooses to take this, or he actually had a choice of two, like a novicely coded version.
It was clever, but clearly showed the immaturity of the product. And then then there was one that was a little bit more well coded, but I think he would have kind of had to start from scratch with the new work that he had to put into it.
Yeah, he had to kind of basically, it was so rigid, he had to kind of tear it down and then learn it. And then figure out what was going on.
And what guided that decision was rule 3, plan to throw one away, you will anyway. So he's saying, like, you know what? Like, I'm going to have to give up some work here. And now looking at this from a step back, I can see that I should probably go with the more mature product because I'm going to have to throw away some code anyway. So let's just do it now.
This is good. We're on like the first chapter and I'm already just like, oh my God, because like how often do I like, I wait to like code something because I'm like, no, I want to have the best idea right now, you know? And it's almost like, no, just like put out a bad one and then whatever that might go away, but you know, then you'll do it again and it'll be great. So it's almost like practice, you know, it's like, oh, I'm not going to go to the driving range to work on my golf swing. You know,
I work with Alex at CodePen. Is very good at this. He knows he's good at vocalizing. It's like, I'm just going to code this because I know it's going to suck, and then I'll figure it out. And even in this, I'll quote from the article, or to put it another way, You often don't really understand the problem until after the first time you implement a solution. The second time, maybe you know enough to do it right. So it's like, just code it once, and then you'll kind of wrap your head around it, and then you can recode it. And if you just... I'm awful at this. I often think like, if I'm going to take the time to do it, I'm going to take the time to do it right. But it's not the case. You should take the time to do it knowing that this code is it's almost like FPO code, you know, for placement only, like in graphic design.
If I was the guy in the 1940s in academia, I'd be just smoking a pipe by a window for like 12 hours a day. And then I would just like write one word. That would be my style. You know,
I think this bugs me in music too. When somebody's like, I haven't put out an album in 8 years. I just need to be in the right perfect mood for it. Oh, inspiration is struck. And I just spit out this album and it's amazing.
One take.
Why does that perpetuate itself? It's like, I want to listen to the person who wrote 50,000 songs and then the 50,003rd song is well practiced. You know, they learned a lot along that journey of writing a lot of songs and that became a thing. Because that's probably closer to the truth, you know? It makes a better... You can say anything you want in a story, but you don't write an amazing song. You don't write 10 amazing songs without writing a couple hundred mediocre ones. I feel like.
Yeah.
So stop perpetuating the myth.
How many Tom Petty tracks are just on the cutting room floor? Just like, he ended up accidentally writing.
Then it makes a better interview to go like, I rented a cabin in the woods and just watched the stream and a beaver was making love to his beaver wife.
Taught me this riff.
Yeah.
Gosh.
It's certainly a better story than every, I wrote 10,000 garbage songs.
Every beaver taught riff. All right. But you know, there's a thing going on in open source, like Node land, where it's like code is disposable. I don't know if you've heard that, but that's a really like, I'm like.
Code is poetry, so thus poetry is disposable.
Whoa. That's a transitive property. But when I react to the like code is disposable and I'm like, no, it's not my precious babies, you know, but I think a good developer knows like, yeah, you kind of have to go because you don't know the dragons like 10 steps down the road yet. You don't know those dragons. So you just have to get to those dragons as fast as possible, probably fail and then start back over.
And of course, it's precious all the way up until the end, you don't care about it at all anymore, which is another interesting juxtaposition. It's kind of like there's a moment at which maybe there's an open source project that you held dear for a little while, and then, you know, maybe slowly or maybe all of a sudden you're just like, I don't care about this anymore.
Yeah.
And Dave, you mentioned FitFids a little bit. I don't know if you're at the moment where you absolutely don't care about it at all anymore. I think we've talked about this in private in the past. At one point, we were going to have this idea, and it's not a totally original idea, but it's one where we'd have a standardized like sunset graphic that you could apply to repos that just try to make it as visually clear as possible. That's like, this is done, you know?
Yeah, this has sort of lived its life. So, yeah, I think, you know, for FitVids, I've had Ken Howard chip in and help quite a bit. So that's been really great. If you're listening, Ken, thank you. I think it's probably time where, yeah, you need to hand off your baby.
In the article, number 5, when you lose interest in a program, your last duty is to hand it off to a competent successor. So, Dave, you may be in the process of doing this.
I'm super bad at this, but I'm bad at this in life, I think, too.
I think at the time that he was writing this, it mattered a little bit more. There just wasn't as many. I mean, I guess that maybe it's not necessarily true because he was kind of saying there was, you know, there's 5-6 mail fetcher things or... But it just kind of seems like today, like, I don't know. I have some repos out there that are like a drop-down alternative, and it's not that good, and I don't have a lot of evidence that there are a lot of people using it. And, like, I'm not going to I don't care if if I pass it down to somebody else. Like, maybe I'm breaking this rule, but it just seems like just sunsetting the thing seems to make a little bit more sense, if not just wiping it off the face of the earth. I guess that would bother an archivist, but...
Well, yeah, I mean, that's, I guess, I don't, I mean, that's an interesting thing. I mean, if you're just like releasing a plugin or something, or just like, here, this is how you do this, that's maybe one thing. But if you're like, what qualifies as a program, I guess is maybe the question too. That's tough, because some people probably depend on that program. You know, maybe a whole university depends on this FetchMail thing he built, and he doesn't know or something. You know, I mean, that could be pretty devastating to a large organization. But maybe that's the thing, is like, maybe it's just your duty to hand it off to somebody who can make the mature decision. Maybe you as the owner or something aren't capable of making a rational decision because you've put so much heart and whatever mind into it.
So we'll see. I think that's one where it seems like a good rule, but maybe, at least to me, doesn't apply to absolutely every piece of open source software. But remember, this was long before, it seems to me, the explosion of open source. In fact, I don't even know what version control looked like back then. Was there version control as we know it? What was it?
It was like CVS. He gets into it actually in the next chapter here, chapter 2. but like RCS and CVS, which are just weird.
Well, there was stuff though. I mean, you could tell who did what and merge conflicts and all that stuff existed then, but maybe it wasn't. It's not like GitHub and Bitbucket are today, or kind of more specifically GitHub, because it's so public, you know, you like browse around it and see what's happening in open source. It's really changed how things go. There's just, you know, anybody is blasting stuff around on GitHub.
Yeah, it would be more like SourceForge, where like if something got lost or broke and then the developer disappeared, it's kind of gone forever, like, because you have no idea where it comes from or who does it, you know. I don't know if you've used SourceForge lately, but it's still suffers from some of the problems it had in the 90s, which is just kind of like, it's a lot of weird information and ads and so...
All right. Well, there is another chapter and many more rules to go over. This is all very interesting, I think. I should mention that the show is brought to you in part by...
LYNDA.com.
Nailed it. We did a... It wasn't quite a melody. We just kind of sang the same note there. It worked out, though. It's LYNDA.com/shoptalk is the URL you go to get your 10-day free trial for the world's largest online training thing. We always say that because it is that.
The world's largest online training thing.
Yeah, well, it's like, it's a website, so certainly you could go there, but they have apps for all your different devices and stuff, and you log into those apps, and then your world comes with you, meaning you can create and save playlists of things you want to watch, or as they say, customize your learning path, or you can kind of share with friends if you have other people doing lynda.com too, and colleagues and team members, and take notes in there, and download them if you want, so you can watch them on other devices. You know, each course has transcripts to follow along with, or you can kind of search for stuff, search for code, search for answers, check out the table of contents of each. You know, it's like 3,000 courses, and that's just courses, and let alone individual videos in those courses, because they're all kind of multi-video things. You know, you like learn step one, do this stuff. Meaning, like, so there's a class called iOS Development with Swift Essential Training. That's one of their ones that's like, that's going to be like a big, like, this is the most important course in Swift land in Lynda. And it will be, you know, you watch the first video introducing
Essential
it.
Training.
ESSENTIAL.
Okay, so Essential Training Swift. Sorry, I interrupted.
No, it's good. It's, I mean, you work your way through the course. It's not like here's a video. It's 4 hours long. Press play and see if you get anything out of it. You know, it's like it's broken into chunks. You watch a smaller video. There's files that go along with it. There's a transcript that goes along with it. And you work your way through it, kind of marking your progress as you go. It's just kind of well laid out that way. So check out lynda.com/shoptalk. Let's talk a little bit. Oh, yeah.
It's basically essential oils for your brain, you know, so.
Omega-3 for your head.
Omega-3 for your brain. Put it in your brain. All right, here we go. Chapter 2, The Importance of Having Users.
That's what its title, I guess. It's I didn't even think of it as chapter 2, but I guess of having users is important, though. I mean, he kind of just talks about in this chapter that his, you know, Linux obviously has tons of users, and your best users, you know, it was funny, though, that the users of this kind of software that he was talking about and using, the people that tend to be those users, he even says here, properly cultivated, they can become co-developers. Like, it was maybe a different time, different products. Yeah. A lot of the stuff we work on, I wouldn't expect your average user to just start committing code back to you, you know?
I mean, that could happen maybe on GitHub or something, but...
Sure, maybe on CodePen here and there, but yeah.
He does kind of, like, draw a big line between coders and normies, you know? He's very, like, normies don't get this stuff, so you want the coders. But I do like the idea, his number 6, which is treating your users as co-developers is your least hassle route to rapid code improvement and effective debugging. I mean, we always are like, focus on the user. So treating your users as, this was interesting to me because, you're always like user-centered design, user-centered UX, blah, blah, but just blah, blah. I don't think of them as co-developers, but in a lot of ways, they are.
You could replace co-developers with respect or with enthusiasm, in a sense. Maybe co-developers, too, but, you know, if somebody sends you a bug report, it's like, kind of what, you know, treat it with the utmost enthusiasm and respect. You know, they're doing work for you.
Right. I mean, not to, like, cross synergy too much, but I was just listening to the CodePen radio podcast about social media, and your users like will tweet things and tell you about bugs on Twitter, and in a lot of ways, because you have such a developer audience, you know, your users on CodePen are kind of co-developers. Do you see them that way, or
I guess, yeah, other guys talk about this a lot. They're I kind of have been used to it at somewhere like CSS Tricks. You know, people will be like, "Oh, there's a problem with this comment form. You should add this line of CSS to fix it." Kind of, I've always been like, "Oh, yeah, you're right." You know, and that's kind of new to these other guys, and they're always amazed by that. And somebody will send in a pen with the demonstration of how to fix something somewhere else on the site. They're like, "Oh, well, that's great.
That's kind of fun.
Oh, I think this should be a feature. Here's how it would work." You know, so it's very much like that at CodePen. Not every project is like that, of course, you know, but it remains true that, you know, treating your users as, you know, as theoretical co-developers is can be a good plan.
I've gotten a CodePen comment that I had a typo in a code comment on a CodePen before, and I almost quit my job. So, But again, thorough is good, you know, and that probably is what is that the next point in this whole thing is just like, or we already said it, but like with enough eyeballs, all bugs are shallow, right? That's a one thing.
It's coming up, I think. I wonder if he also gives credit to Linus Torvald. He brings up a lot, and this is kind of a related point that I think is interesting, is that I think Linus's cleverest and most consequential hack was not the construction of the Linux kernel itself, but rather his invention of the Linux development model, which is interesting, right? So he wasn't, he was clever, but his most clever thing was getting thousands of developers to build something cohesively.
Okay, yeah, keep going. Sorry.
He says, when I expressed this opinion in his presence once, he smiled and quietly repeated something he has often said. I'm basically a very lazy person who likes to get credit for things other people actually do, which is just that's part of the plan there, too, is to be coy about it. But really, he says he's taking credit, but he's not really. He's doing it with a grin kind of thing. And he says, lazy like a fox. You know, that's clever, you know.
I want that on my tombstone, just lazy like a fox. This is interesting. It's cool that he's citing Linus, like, a lot. Kind of, like, borderline idol worship. I don't know where you probably a 6 on that scale. Is that right?
Yeah, 6.5.
But 6.5, creeping up. But then, like, Linus ends up kind of being a total D-bag. I mean, you've read those articles, right? Like,
I didn't know that, actually. Is that the case?
Like, he just, like, berates people, and he's like, you F-bomb, tootin' F-bomb, toot-faced.
Did something happen in his life that made him like that, or did it just, or it turns out he was always like that?
I think it's either, like, two things. I think it's, like, you either become this hard-crusted troll man from because you do so much open source software and have to deal with so many people chipping in their bad opinions or good opinions, or he's just maybe this, you know, punchy kind of guy, you know, like this charismatic guy who just basically like says things for shock and awe, maybe to control the room or the email thread, but more or less just like it sort of has created some like caustic environments, and there may be some posts over on model view culture about it, but and I realize model view culture it has some debates around itself as well, but there it's just this kind of idea that he's maybe kind of a very harsh individual on and very alienating to people kind of learning and wanting to help, I guess.
Weird. I wonder if that was always the case. Is how could it have been so successful so early on if he was that caustic that early? It kind of seems to me like maybe the caustic stuff came later. But who knows? I don't know. I don't know the story.
If you just Google Linus Torvalds a-hole.
I know. It just was.
you get a few hits.
Okay, well, that's how you might get some opinions on it. All right, I did mention at the end of this chapter that there have been other software products with two-level architecture and two-tier user community that combined a cathedral mode core and a bizarre mode toolbox. I kind of like that too, that this isn't necessarily just straight up two sides. You either go this way or you go this way. And I'd like to think that I could use that more effectively. And I guess I can get into that a little bit more later. But how does it even affect you, Dave? I mean, with new products you work on, you're probably not going full open source with Daytrip, right? But is there some way that you can leverage some bizarre action with it? Or maybe will go for open source? I kind of doubt it.
No, I mean, like, at some point, you can't. Once you're hosting users' data, you know, like, I can't, like, hand over keys to my server, you know. I guess I could make it open source, but I probably just wouldn't, is sort of maybe for security kind of reasons. But let's see. So, I don't know. But there are, I think, like, you do this very well, like, where you talk about your business, you know. One thing, my father-in-law, he's a rose farmer. He farms roses for a living, and he's like, so Dave is going to these conferences. He's like talking to my wife about this. He's like, Dave's going to these conferences, right? And my wife's like, yep. And he's like, and he's just giving away trade secrets. Is that what's happening? He's just like, yep. And so I think it's this interesting thing. It's like, we are very sherry, you know, like all of our,
Think of this the other day. I was like, what is it? So rose farmers don't share, but I was like, I wonder if do chefs share? And it's like, yeah, it kind of seems like they do. Like they're all about sharing food and just how they do it. And it's usually no big secret. It's just practice and stuff. And I was like, do doctors share? Yeah, of course they do. They can't wait to get published in a medical journal and stuff. And I was struggling to think of one that's not sherry. We pat ourselves on the back for being sherry, but is it true that most professions aren't? I mean, I guess rose farmers aren't.
Well, I mean, yeah, like, how do you grow a rose in extreme heat? Or, you know, like, there is some sharing, you know, just like, hey, here's, like, you have to do this, blah, blah, blah. But, like, you know, if you think of sales is kind of a big one. You know, people are very kind of secrety about how they make sales happen, you know, because it might involve some kind of, like, weird manipulation or something. But there's also, you know, people in software who are like, we did this, I'm going to tell you about it in exchange for attention, so you'll think I'm cool and use my product. Does that sound right?
Mm-hmm.
But But I mean, I think what y'all are doing with CodePen, you're sharing your process very transparently, you know, and I think that's kind of as close as you can get, or maybe that's the two tier, you know, it's the cathedral and the open source, because you guys have this cathedral, the CodePen system, but you also have, you know, it drives a lot of open source collaboration. And so maybe it's both.
Perhaps. So. Part of the bizarre is like people that like come in and they have their own agenda and actually work on the core thing with their own agenda, and somehow that still kind of works out.
Yeah, it all comes together. Could you imagine doing CodePen in the open?
And that's one thing. Goodness. I guess we could take a break to say that what are some things about this essay so far, even as a whole, that it didn't address? And I, you know, to start that discussion, I would think one of the things is money. And it really, I don't think it barely touches on that at all. Or maybe I just missed that part and I'm just an idiot or whatever. But it seems like it would be distasteful, possibly, for us to... I don't know if it's distasteful. I guess I just don't know how I feel about it yet, but it seems like I want CodePen to be a business that makes money for me and the people that are part of CodePen. It's a business. It's a carpet cleaning business. You know, you expect a carpet cleaning business to make money for them and theirs, right? This is a web version of that. It's not a hippie colony or whatever. I'm trying to not be rude about this or whatever, but it's just, I'm trying to be like, it's just a business. To be like, everybody help me. Everybody come over here. Start writing code, you know? It seems like, at what point does that seem distasteful, kind of? Like, all these projects that are talked about and all this thing are free. They're open source free products. Nobody pays for Linux. Nobody pays for Emacs. But it seems like what happened? What about products that you want to make money off of? That's kind of the point. Like, how does that factor into Cathedral and a Bazaar? Do you have to use Cathedral then? Or?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I don't know. There is this idea, you know, people are like, you can't make money off of open source, but like Automattic is like a $1 trillion business, right? Or whatever. So I think it's just this idea that, like Node.js is it, or whatever they are now, IO, Node, whatever those guys are, like that's open source. And then people sell the support to float the boat. That's what Ember's doing as well. They have Ember as a product or an open source product, and then they sell the kind of like premium support to large orgs, you know.
It would be a different business model. It could be done too. I mean, it could be done for any of the projects we work on, but it would be like, we'll just make all of CodePen free, but we'll make some kind of enterprise product that you can install behind a firewall or whatever, and we'll charge for that, or there'll be some, you know, support contracts we sell or something, or maybe there's some very specific premium features that you, I don't know. I don't know, but it would be different than what we do now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyway, I guess it doesn't necessarily draw a line in the sand, but it does feel like certainly money and business model factor into this, and it's just not covered.
Yeah, there's another book by Richard Stallman who's mentioned in this. It's a free book called Free as in Freedom, and it's all about open source as well. But it's a bit older. It's about, like, it's not email clients, which are super hot, like, this last couple of years, by the way. But it's a printer drivers, so it's a little rougher read. But maybe that's the next book, next time we do this. But it's a little bit more about, like, you know, how to get hackers attracted and what is hacker. And there's actually another RSB article about hackers, but I don't know. Every time I read a hacker article, it sort of reinforces that, like, neckbearded, you know, like, I don't know.
Awful word.
So it reinforces this, like, male, you know, coder in a basement stereotype that I don't like. So anyway, I don't like reinforcing that stereotype. So,
and if it does,
I say it with a stereotype accent.
Or means nothing.
What?
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, let's do a sponsor quick. Oh gosh, there's so much open source going to be cooking at this thing, the CSS DevConf, you know, it's the URL if you go to CSS DevConf, it'll redirect you to the year. You know, this is 2015 CSS DevConf. It's fourth year aboard the Queen Mary in Long Beach, California. That's right.
Trying that out.
That's right. Try that too. I wonder if they'll blast the horn. There's three huge smokestacks on the thing. I wonder if they like burned coal to run the ship at one time.
Oh, yeah.
They probably
did. It's shipped out in like 1919 or something.
Oh, super old.
Oh, yeah.
This is before nuclear power. October 26th through 28th. So it's coming up here in a few months. It's going to be super beautiful out there, I'm sure. Can't wait. Gina Bolton, me and Dave, Valhead, Jonathan Sook, Sarah Swaydan. Those are the kind of the some people. But, go to /speakers. Or I guess it's you look at the schedule to see who's going on. They actually do a really nice job with the schedule, too. It's using one of those services where you can kind of, like, line up your day. What do you want to see and when and stuff? Oh, Sarah Drasner, Philip Walton, Gregor Adams. Oh, this is going to be fun.
The schedule, I got that the other week. It looks hot.
Look hot. And it's multi-track, but not multi-track such that you are going to miss things that you want to see because people vote on the things that are very good. And then at the end, those presenters redo them, which is pretty cool. So you, for sure, if you go to the very end, we'll see the best stuff. Oh, look at that. 4 p.m. closing keynote, Dave Rupert.
Uh-oh. I think I just figured out my talk, and it's going to involve Alan Alda, so look forward to it.
Oh, very nice. Yeah, I'm going to be bouncing around, saying hi. I'm going to do a Q&A kind of thing. Should be pretty good. Cool. So CSSDevConf.com is the URL for that. It's going to be a good old time. Please come to it. As this goes on, one of the most more obvious chapters, perhaps, that pretty much everybody buys into, release early and often. In fact, that's rule number 7, literally release early and often. It's just one of those things, like do work, get it out there, let people see it and react to it. That's way more bazaar-like than cathedral-like. Although you'd gotta guess, you know, like if Apple's developing Final Cut Studio 8, or I just made that up, you know. But they must have some internal release thing. It's not like they can just, I mean, they must be releasing to some group of users to find bugs before it ships out the door, you know.
I mean, maybe, or maybe they do a master merge month. You know, like,
I don't know.
And it's just like, okay, everybody land your plane. Let's go. But I would hope they do something. But anyway, this is really good. I think I've seen this in my own life. The second you kind of stop releasing often, you sort of, I don't know, inertia just plummets. You could almost chart a drop-off graph about it.
You can get it. You can get it back. But yeah, certainly it's once you've stopped for a minute, it becomes more daunting in your own brain.
Yeah, not necessarily the project is more daunting. I mean, let's use FitVids as an example. It's maybe 30 lines of code, and people have like committed 3 lines of code. But I'm like, it's just gonna take. Oh, that's like 10% of the code base. Oh, you know, I have an unhealthy attitude, but it's because I've lost the momentum. You know. I've even seen this on day trip, like with closed source, but like, you know, I like in the switch to Windows, and this is the full transparency, like Ruby on Rails is pretty busted in Windows right now. I think it's going to get fixed like this week, but it's pretty busted. And so it's really hard to get that up and running. And so I haven't like, I've been mostly Windows, but there's been a couple times I had to bounce over to fix something. But I haven't done much on day trip this month. And that's a bummer because it's, you know, basically slipped a lot of opportunity and momentum. So that's, you know, but I'm enjoying Windows. So I guess there's a trade-off. But anyway, I've noticed in my own life that release early, release often affects your happiness. And then
sure.
And
I mean, I think it's affected to bugs, right? That bugs, if you release often and there a bug happens, it was like, well, it was related to this very small release. It's very easy to see where that bug came from, which is related to the next thing, which is basically the rule is given enough eyeball, all bugs are shallow.
And
yeah.
Oh,
Go for it.
Well, he makes a really good argument for this. I feel like, because he's saying, like, if you release early, release often, and the all bugs are shallow thing go hand in hand. Because if you don't release often and you ship a bug, your users will be like, oh, this is going to be buggy for weeks, months, years, you know?
I see. But if you have a regular release schedule, you're like, no big deal. It'll be fixed next week kind of thing. Or at least that's the perception.
Yeah, you have a kind of a mindset going on, an internal mindset. But he also makes the point, like, he's like, if I build something and I test it, you know, I'm probably not that thorough, or I'm like focused in on one thing, and then and if I even hand it off to a QA team and do a whole QA cycle, and maybe they are only looking for the things they look for, you know, and you actually don't get a, you know, a 100-person test, you know, QA suite until you release it to the public, you know. So I think he makes a really good kind of rule. It's like, if you ship it to QA, you get, you know, it'll get bounced back by QA if there's a bug, and maybe you saved yourself some time. But like, if you ship it to everyone, it'll still get bounced back to you, you know. So it's like the QA step is almost superfluous, you know, kind of unnecessary. And now we probably automate a lot more testing than they did back then, but I don't know.
The shallowness comes from, you know, they're given enough eyeballs. You know, it's like there's enough people looking at the code base that the fix is obvious to someone, as they say, that, you know, it may seem weird to you, be like, oh, that's a weird bug. It feels daunting to me. But somebody's like, oh, I was just looking at that code. I can go grab it. But it's not necessarily enough, but it's enough with wide coverage. I've definitely seen very large apps, and there a bug comes along. And unfortunately, even though there's a lot of people that work on the project as a whole, there's very few people that look on just the billing portion of this app or something, or that app, you know, if somebody left and they were the only person that knew a lot about that code, and now there's somebody struggling to look at it stuff. It's not just the number of people, it's the coverage.
Yeah, like you have more dark corners if you kind of silo everything up, right? So, because, like, yeah, no one's working on billing. Well, guess what? Billing's broken now. So you don't find that out till later, you know?
In this chapter, he brings up the Delphi effect too, which I hadn't heard of, but the way he kind of describes it is similar to the wisdom of the crowds, which I think is more common these days to talk about. And it's at least the wisdom of the crowds. Maybe you've heard of it. It's like, there, you know, there's a if you go to the fair and there's a cow, and you ask 2,000 people how much the cow weighs. Almost nobody knows how much a cow weighs, but for some magical way, the average of those people, when you remove the really ridiculous outliers, is usually really, really close. Or how many gumballs are in the gumball thing, or, you know, you ask enough people, the average is usually really accurate, which is super weird, right? That's like one of the coolest, weirdest phenomenons I've ever heard of. But it can apply to software development too, and the number of people kind of working on a project can have those same kind of effects.
Yeah, I think. And that's maybe people kind of using it, right? Not necessarily developing on it. Because he also talks about Brooks' Law and the mythical man month.
Observers. And, yeah. It's that, yeah.
But, yeah. I got into the mythical man month. I had to pull, like, he cites a formula about, like, the number of developers and then, like, the communication load. And after three developers, basically, the communication load goes higher than your progress, basically. So it was interesting, and I think
it has to do with maintaining the software, right?
Yeah, or here's Brooks' Law is
more users find more bugs is the point, right?
Yeah, that was more users find more bugs, but the like converse is you can't just throw developers at it. That's kind of Brooks', yeah, like mythical man month.
Oh, I see.
And it's just basically that the interfaces between code written by different people are. Bugs tend to strongly cluster at the interfaces between code written by different people, and that communications, coordinations, overhead on a project tend to rise with the number of interfaces between humans. So it's basically you count the number of I guess, nodes between people. Like, let's say there's two people, there's one node, right, in between people. And if there's three people, there's like three nodes. And then after that, it's like you can have, it's a spider web, and it's, there's so many points of communication that where problems can happen. So it's basically like the number of points of communication equal the number of problems you're going to have on software. So sort of, I'm paraphrasing it badly. So yeah. Hey, chapter 7.
Yeah, there's so much to talk about here. We're only I'm half or a third of the way through this potentially, and we're already coming up on an hour. So maybe we'll powerfully through it. Just we'll just go through a few more of the rules without the context potentially, just so that you guys get a taste of this more. I think number 9 here, way down, is that smart data structures and dumb code work a lot better than the other way around. That's hard to do without context, but maybe we'll just let that sit there.
Have better data than smarter code. Number 10, if you treat your beta testers as if they're your most valuable resource, they will respond by becoming your most valuable resource.
Dun, dun, dun.
Sort of a self-help axiom.
We talked about that a little bit already, I think.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The next best thing to having good ideas is recognizing good ideas from your users. Sometimes the latter is better, meaning that your users' ideas might be better than your own. Very strong, very modern concept as well. That has stood the test of time. I feel like that's talked about very often, is that, you know, it's pivoting, and words like that are related to this.
Yeah, well, in his situation, it paid off huge because he was able to offload a whole bunch of gnarly bad code, right, to this guy's idea. So I thought that was pretty darn cool.
I didn't even think about that. But yeah, it's true. It's like, you know, we get a good idea from a CodePen user. We implement it. They're happy. Theoretically, there's other people like them and they're happy. But in the world of open source, you'd be like, this is a really good idea. Let me work on it. And can you please come help me work on it? Because it's your idea. You're probably interested in doing that. It's a way in for some smart people, for you to get some smart people to work with you. Very cool.
Well, in recognizing that, hey, that is a smart idea, let's do it, is very strong. You know, I mean, otherwise you're just sort of like, if you just say yes to everything, or even if you like just don't accept good ideas, you're not going to get good help, I guess, is sort of the thing. So, and that's the thing. He doesn't talk about how to deal with bad ideas, and that's interesting. But anyway, well, that's maybe another whole podcast. So number 12, often the most striking and innovative solutions come from realizing your concept of the problem was wrong.
Yeah, that's similar. Is that you had an idea for your thing, but you better be willing to realize that it was wrong, or that you know, it should be treated with equal weight. Your good idea and a revelation that an idea was wrong.
Number 13. Perfection in design is achieved not when there's nothing more to add, but rather when there's nothing more to take away.
That's a quote from Antoine Saint-Exupéry or whatever. I forget who that is. Yep. I recognize that one. But yeah, that's
Aviator.
That seems a little highbrow. You know, you're definitely wearing a beret when you say that. It's true, but also feels very like, you know, you're smoking a cigarette with a holder in it.
Yep, writing a Medium article. Mm. But it makes sense. I mean, I think it's just...
It's a good one.
Just take things, like, strip away, make it as good as possible. And that fits the Unix philosophy of, like, only do one thing well, you know?
Mm. 14 is any tool should be useful in the expected way, but any truly great tool lends itself to uses you've never expected. I think that's the... what's the Good Eats guy?
Blanking.
Shoot, that's embarrassing. I don't, fortunately. Alton Brown, or he doesn't have single-use tools in his kitchen. It's like a thing. Anyway, that's what I thought of. But I don't know if that necessarily is exactly right, but I don't know.
Well, I think about, like, my son, you know, he picks up sticks, and they are guitars to him. You know,
sure.
No one intended that to be a guitar, but it's a guitar to him, and it brings many people great joy. So... there you go. But in software, it's probably like, I didn't know you could use Flexbox that way. Oh my gosh. So there you go.
Good point. Yeah.
Number 15, when writing gateway software of any kind, take pains to disturb the data stream as little as possible and never throw away information unless the recipient forces you to, exclamation point.
Write a good API and have queuing servers that don't dump data. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. That one is sort of very specific to a situation, but I guess, you know, I don't know. We could probably abstract that into a larger post, but yeah, no, not going to do it. And then sort of just takes off, doesn't it? The number 16, when your language is nowhere near Turing complete, JavaScript, syntactic sugar can be your friend, jQuery.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, syntactic sugar is still a very commonly used phrase. It came up in some code I was just editing yesterday, you know, in the context of, you know, if you can think of SVG elements, there's like circle and rect and, you know, all of them, polyline. They're all syntactic sugar for the path element, which you may or may not realize, I guess. Oh,
yeah, I guess so. It's just...
because the path element can draw them too. It's just a little more programmatically friendly.
Yeah, interesting. Number 17, I liked, a security system is only secure as its secret. Beware of pseudo secrets,
which again was very specific to this. But yeah, it's you know, security by obscurity is stupid kind of thing, right?
But you, y'all, CodePen Radio again, Max Synergy here. The secrets episode you guys had
is a really
good example of this, because you're just like, what secrets do we have? Who has access to those secrets? That's, you know, those are security problems.
Some of them are very literal, like AWS server keys and stuff. What do you do with those? How do you keep them out of Git? That kind of thing. Although, you read the article, because it was pretty interesting, this one. It was pretty like it seemed like something that was going to be secure, but for obscure reasons, it wasn't. Anyway, so there's only one more of these, right? Or is there?
There are two more.
Okay.
Number 18, to solve an interesting problem, start by finding a problem that is interesting to you.
Very similar to number one.
Mm-hmm. And then number 19, provided the development coordinator has a communications medium at least as good as the internet. Okay. And knows how to lead without coercion. Okay. Many heads are inevitably better than one.
So it's trying to say many heads are better than one with a whole bunch of preconditions to that.
Right. You have to have email and not be an a-hole, I guess is the...
heads are better than one as long as you, have... Gosh, that's hard to wrap my head around.
Well, I think of it, you know, the Node community is probably a really great example of this. They have a very strong core team. You hear the word core team, right? Mm-hmm. A lot. Like if a core team is good and they can lead without like manipulating and politicking background sort of things, that's awesome and healthy. You know, I think, you know, they hit the IOJS hot drama sort of thing, like because one company wanted to kind of maintain control, but you know, that's sort of the coercion. So they're like, peace out. We're going to just be core team over here. And now it's getting rolled back in together. So
I guess rule number, there is no rule number 20. It should have been rule number 20 is that you can have an odd number of rules. It's okay.
you don't have to accommodate OCD people who really, really, really want to go to 20. A number divisible by 10.
We could have talked a lot longer on this because each one of these rules, there are things that we probably could have connected and stuff to our own projects, but this is a new format to us and we didn't really realize how long we could go on and on about this stuff, but wow.
It's pretty great. Again, thanks Nikki and Liz for the inspiration. Obviously, this is a way cool way to do a show. So everyone go subscribe to PageBreak in your podcatcher of choice. But Chris, what did you think of the booklet in general? Like, was it a good read? Would you thumbs it up? Would you recommend it? What would your feeling?
I would, or just listen to this show. I mean, I think we covered it pretty well.
We quoted it verbatim. So, that's what's weird is you just listen to an hour show. You could be about 85% the way through the book. if you had not listened to the show instead.
Yeah, yeah, you really probably could have been there.
But I think it's so cool. I think it's amazing that a book about software can withstand the test of
time.
And
it doesn't bother all the Emacs and Linux stuff. It's not bothersome. And maybe it helps that those products still exist. So it's interesting to think about. It's less fun when the things they're talking about are obscure to you or are already dead. And so they have their own baggage or something that you're bringing with it.
Right.
But in this case, that's not true. So it tends to not be annoying as you're reading through it. And I found that to be very true with Design for Community, too, that Derek Pawazek book I brought at the beginning, is that it's prophetic and interesting and very relevant to today. And the stuff that's in there that feels old, it's like it doesn't hurt.
Right. It's not this is borderline, like it starts hurting, but it's still really good.
Right, because there's a few things that have changed. Anyway, so enjoy that. We'll have links to all this stuff in the show notes, of course, all the things that we mentioned. I hope you enjoy it. Let us know what you know about the format for the show. Of course, we'll probably come back to you know, Q&A style shop talk at some point. That's kind of the meat and potatoes. But we're just going to explore a little bit. I also wanted to tell you that Shop Talk is brought to you in part by our sponsors, but also in part by the Shop Talk job board. It's literally at shoptalkshow.com/jobs. So it works both ways, a job board. If your company is hiring, please post your jobs there. We've had a lot of great success stories of people finding front-end developers, kind of sometimes a rare beast to hire. You know how valuable you are, potentially, if you listen to this show. And for people looking for jobs, especially if you don't like your job, that's why I love having that there, because we can hopefully kind of inspire you to look and see what's out there and possibly find a better job if you don't like the one you're at. We get questions like that of people that are unhappy about their job all the time at Shop Talk Show. Here's a particular one that I really think you'll like. The company is called Upstatement, and we just had an article go out on CSS Tricks, and the title of the article is, let me read it verbatim because I love the title of it. It feels a little like BuzzFeedy or whatever, but it's I went with it. Timber and Twig reignited my love for WordPress. I was like, oh, that's a perfect title because it's specific. It's got the keywords in there. It was by a guy named TJ Fogarty. And Timber is Twig is PHP templating. It's like mustache for PHP, essentially. And Timber is the thing that makes that all happen in WordPress, so your ability to use Twig. And it makes your templates look way nicer. So instead of having to write PHP open thingy echo the title function call end PHP statement, you know, and there's that stuff all over, you just go like, you know, curly brace, title, curly brace, you know, and it makes your templates look good. And while it's doing that, it's kind of separating the view concerns from the data concerns. So it's kind of MV or more like CV. Anyway, that was a big thing, right? Timber and Twig. The makers of Timber are Upstatement. So this is a job that's there, but it's not all they do. It's not like they just make that. They're a big agency, and they do lots of interesting things. And when they see interesting things happen, they let it flourish, like the case of Timber. So in this case, you know, it's an agency. The job is a senior interactive designer, which is great. Senior jobs means money, which is cool usually. You know, they're like, but it's all the stuff. It's like you're qualified. You're almost qualified, you know, not automatically if you listen to the show, but it's the stuff that we talk about on this show. You know, HTML, CSS, SCSS, being a designer, having a keen eye for detail, that type of stuff. So, we'll put the link to this Upstatement job in there. It looks like a particularly good one. And, you know, I've said before on the show, when the website you go to for the job looks really nice, you know, it's a good, you know, like they care about their own website. I think that's a really good sign. And this is a hot looking page.
They got quite a few jobs, so check it out. They also worked on Boston Globe. You might know that site. Mm. Yeah, so yeah, that's great. Well, All right. You've been listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show. We thank you for listening. Be sure to subscribe to this in your podcatcher of choice, and rate it, star it, heart it, whatever, so that people can find out about the show. We really appreciate that. And if you hate your job, get a new job, shoptalkshow.com/jobs. And I can't think of anything else. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show. Chris, what's the last word?
The cathedral and the shoptalkshow.com.